One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Donald L. Enders is a longtime researcher and sites restorer in the Historical Sites Division of the Church's Historical Department. His projects include most of the well-known restorations performed by the Church over the past 45 years, notably Nauvoo, that we will be discussing today. Faithful Legacy listeners will recognize Don having talked with us previously about Palmyra. Don, welcome back to Legacy.
Very nice to be with you.
As I understand it, your career with the Church is quickly coming to an end here.
That's right. At the end of this month of October, if it was Halloween, I was told they would give me a broom and I'd fly out of here. But it's on the last Friday of the month. I'll be out on the sidewalk looking back.
So tell us about your career. I would just like to talk about what you've done over the past 45 years.
Back in May of 1965, I was privileged to go to work for Nauvoo Restoration. And my mentor was T. Edgar Lyon, who was the research historian, a marvelous soul, not only in his competency as a scholar, but his goodness. He was a wonderful soul, and so I was tutored by him. And I was obtaining a degree at the time in archaeology at BYU, and then became a member of the archaeological team, and was fortunate to work under the direction of J.C. Harrington and his wife, Virginia, both accomplished archaeologists. And they also had a third person of very qualified ability, George Miller, who has since become one of the country's foremost ceramicists, who really knows the data that archaeologists look at in the ground. And so I had the privilege of working with those folks. And then over the 7 years that I was at Nauvoo, we first excavated the Brigham Young home site. And in fact, in complete detail, we did a dig there. Then at the Jonathan Browning site and other sites. But the key one was the Nauvoo Temple site, where we labored for 3 summers. And that was a really nice experience to catch some firsthand view of things that folks had not seen since the temple was built.
Last time we spoke with you about Palmyra, today we're talking about Nauvoo. What are some of the other sites that you've worked on over the years?
Well, in one degree or another, every site in the U.S. in church history, from the birthplace to Palmyra, which, of course, is comprised of a number of sites like the Book of Mormon Historic Publication Site or the Grandin Building, the Smith Farm, and Peter Whitmer Farm, and then off in Kirtland, the Whitney Store and Ashery and Sawmill and Schoolhouse and other things, and Nauvoo, gracious sakes, it was been a really nice experience. So not only the archaeological digs, but assisting with the restoration of buildings. As time went on, and I hopefully was able to develop some proficiency with what are these things in the ground, this broken dishware and the metal and the beads and the buttons and the glassware. And what are they, and when were they made, and how would they have come in the form of an object to Nauvoo? What brought them there? What were the imports and the exports? And what was in the 1840s and what was not, and how did the period differ? You know, learning about furniture and artifacts and tools. And so had the privilege of working with such places as Carthage Jail and Wilford Woodruff site and Brigham Young sites there as well, the Webb Blacksmith and Wagon Shop and Sarah Granger Kimball and Riser Boot and Shoe Shop and Pendleton Log Home and others that I'm not remembering at the moment.
So these items that are that we find in the ground after so many years, that is a connection with the past. Is there any one or a couple of things that really stand out in your mind that are not necessarily so valuable but are significant?
Well, it's just to preface an answer to that, nails and glass and buttons and all these things, they evolve like clothing styles do. And those are the things that help you to pinpoint when additions to buildings were built or when flooring was added to a structure, moldings, whatever. Those are the things that key in on things. I suppose that one of the great experiences was to labor on the Nauvoo Temple site and to help excavate that area where the baptismal font was located, and there to find remnants of the baptismal font, not only the oxen, but the rim around the font, things that, when the Icarians came in after the Latter-day Saints left and attempted to make the temple a structure suitable to them, the breaking up of the baptismal font and those things left a lot of fragments around that have since become key objects for understanding the quality of craftsmanship of Latter-day Saints, and the kind of work that they gave to the temple and how proficient they were. And all of those kinds of things have certainly added dimensions.
Since we are talking about Nauvoo, from a previous legacy discussion, I learned that the name Nauvoo was chosen and announced by the first presidency in an April 1840 edition of the Millennial Star. And in defining the term Nauvoo, they wrote, "The name of our city is of Hebrew origin and signifies a beautiful situation or place, carrying with it also the idea of rest." And I think that's the first time I had actually associated the word rest with beautiful, and how significant that was for the saints as they tried to actually settle into this new place.
Well, Nauvoo certainly is a beautiful place. The years that my wife and I were privileged to live there, we experienced some of the most magnificent sunsets and the sun bathing the landscape and the river, and it's a tranquil, restful, beautiful place. Nauvoo apparently is parts of two words that come from Sephardic Hebrew. I've now forgotten a little bit about that, but I believe that Professor Satius, if I'm remembering correctly, was a scholar of the Sephardic Hebrew. And at least in time, we get a volume that was available to Joseph where he drew from these Na and Vu to create the name for this city and express that place of rest and peace and tranquility.
So before they got to the naming, they had to do something to lay this city out. What had to take place before they could actually start making streets, sidewalks, and plots?
There were approximately 100 people living on the promontory before Latter-day Saint occupation began in 1839. Such folks as Hiram Kimball, whom Sarah Granger Kimball, a Latter-day Saint girl in time, was to marry. But there were others. There was this little place of commerce that had been laid out. But as the Latter-day Saints take advantage of property acquisitions there, a major thing that needed to be done, of course, was, you know, to create in their mind a layout of the city, but then to begin to deal with the land, to dig drainage ditches that would drain the water from the lower areas of Nauvoo. Folks like to say that Nauvoo was a swamp. Well, it was wet. It was swampy in certain areas, but it's not maybe the traditional perspective that most folks have. But these drainage systems allowed the land to dry and somewhat quickly. Brigham Young's property, Brigham and Mary Ann Young's property was in a wet area when he went off to England on his mission with the 12 and dried pretty well during his absence. And he was able then, when he gets back, to actually dig a cellar and rock it up and build a brick home. The 100 acres across the western side of the promontory adjacent to the river always did remain wet to the point where it couldn't be subdivided but became kind of a common area. And so most of the building in the flats was on the north, east, and south sides of that large wet area, and then up along the bluffs and on to the upper areas up beyond the temple. But yes, there was lots of planning. Drain, dry the place, lay out roads, begin to lay out the city. And there were various segments of the city that land purchases that were made that were brought in and tied into the city. One of the unfortunate things was is that Joseph's plan and hope for a city where all of the streets would be laid out north, south, east, and west and would all tie together into a grid was never quite realized, because there were those who owned properties who weren't always willing for the property to be purchased or to be divided in the manner that Joseph had hoped. So some of the streets didn't always tie together. You had to do some circumventing to get to your locations.
So you mentioned the purchasing of the land. How did that come about? It seems like the church would have been a little strapped at this time for cash to buy land, and I'm not quite clear on how that would have taken place.
Well, in a nutshell, it was Isaac Gallen was one of the first. It was long terms to pay it off and relatively good prices. And then the effort was made to try to meet those demands. And certainly it was a struggle even then.
So it seems that I've heard they tried to use the basic, when I say basic, the Missouri plan for like the city of Zion when they platted Nauvoo. Is that correct?
Well, it certainly smacks of that a great deal. For example, there's the center area, the religious focal area, would be the temple. And then there would be commercial structures around that, multitudes of shops and stores, and then your residential areas and farming areas. But in Nauvoo, we get both up on the bluffs near the temple, commercial areas, and then down on the flat along Main Street, we get commercial areas. So it wasn't able to tie into the Zion plan as strictly as the scriptural references for Zion suggest.
For a time, was planning and building a new city from the ground up a common occurrence for this time, I should say, or was this like a unique characteristic of Latter-day Saint city building?
Well, you have Washington, D.C. as an example of that. Platting and growing up quickly. It was quite an unusual, very unusual thing for a large group of people to arrive and commence the construction of a city. Usually those have just kind of emerged step by step. And although Nauvoo would grow step by step, nonetheless, there was this, all of a sudden, they're on the banks of the Mississippi in Hancock County, Illinois. This city on this promontory in the river grew up. There are letters, of course, from Nauvoo that express something about the growth of the city, but it's quite a thing that from 1839 by 1846, Nauvoo has become the second largest city in the state of Illinois, always behind Chicago a wee bit, but that it grows beyond Springfield and other places just quite rapidly. On the eve of the Exodus, a census was taken. I think that was in late 1845, if I'm remembering correctly. And within the city limits, the incorporated area, there were 11,037 people, I think. It was suggested that outside of that area, there probably were another 3,000, and that would spill over into the Iowa settlements as well as Zarahemla and other places. But so at the time that the Exodus began, there probably were 12, 13, 14,000 people living in that area of Nauvoo, which was a large population.
Thank you. We're talking today with Don Enders of the church's historical department. We're discussing Nauvoo and its growth and some of the archaeology, and we're going to get into some more specifics here real soon. You talk about the growth. The expulsion from Missouri was perhaps the initial, people who came to Nauvoo. And where did these people come from? Were we still in Kirtland at the time, or where did they all come from to make the city grow so quickly?
There were still some folks in Kirtland, of course, but many Latter-day Saints were leaving Kirtland, going to Zion. And at the time of the Missouri difficulties, we had Latter-day Saints spread out all the way from Kirtland to Missouri. And those that learned of the Missouri difficulties, quite a number, took root in places in Indiana and Illinois and et cetera, and took up residence till they could find out what was happening with this Missouri challenge. The bitterness of the Missouri difficulties for the Latter-day Saints resulted in the expulsion of at least 5,000, maybe a few more Latter-day Saints. Those Latter-day Saints were compelled, for the most part, to leave the state of Missouri and went eastward. They were not permitted by government law to go westward into Indian territory, so they returned eastward and crossed the Mississippi. Many ended up in Quincy, and then it was, of course, near this time in 1839 that Joseph and Hiram are able to get out of Liberty Jail, out of that experience. And then, of course, with the desire to gather the Latter-day Saints, this land up the Mississippi River at Commerce, what became Nauvoo, manifests itself. And many of those Missouri Saints, of course, then would settle there. And then converts from the eastern states, the Atlantic seaboard, New England, et cetera, then would begin coming in. And then, of course, with the missions to Great Britain, commencing 1839 through 41 by the Quorum of 12 and then followed up after their return, many English would emigrate to Nauvoo. In fact, at the time of the Exodus, it's suggested that approximately a third of the population were British Saints. So there was quite a smattering, and even some folks from more southern areas were beginning to come into the church who were converts to the church. So Nauvoo is became a cosmopolitan in cultural makeup, a cosmopolitan place.
So they lay the city out, and they had to start building some homes to house this influx of people. What were the homes like?
Well, that's a really good question. At the time that the church had, under the Quorum of 12, had planned to make this exodus and go to the Rocky Mountains, it was advertised that there were some 2,400 residences in the Nauvoo area, in the city and outside, that would be available for sale. It was suggested that 300 to 500 would be brick structures. And, of course, they would range from single-story structures to two-story. In fact, there was at least one three-story structure in Nauvoo of a brick, a residence. There were other buildings such as the Masonic Hall, Cultural Hall, that was a three-story structure. But 300 to 500 brick structures, it was suggested that there may be as many as 500 to 800 frame structures, which of course, would have ranged in footprint and size from single-story, one-and-a-half-story, two-story structures, and that there probably were somewhere in the neighborhood of as many as 1,400 log structures and even less quality structures that ranged in from good quality log homes, two stories, to down to very small log cabins. And folks could, with the Latter-day Saints leaving, folks could come in and, if they desired, acquire some structures at very minimal prices. In fact, a number of properties, with so many Latter-day Saints leaving the area, many of the properties, some of the properties sold for taxes at just modest amounts. I'm thinking of the David Yearsley home, which was the three-story brick structure that I'm recalling sold for $1.37.5 for taxes. But three men were left in Nauvoo to represent the church and sell properties. Actually, all but three properties, to the best of my knowledge, were sold. Most folks didn't realize a great deal out of them. Some realized, you know, some acceptable prices, but mostly not. If a family was able to get a wagon and a team of oxen or some horses in exchange for a good home and their property that was planted with fruit trees and gardens, etc., they felt fortunate. So most folks did not realize anywhere near the value of the properties, I'm sure.
You mentioned in your notes here that there was about a 40% increase in population from the first to the second year in Nauvoo, and that's a huge influx. Where did these people work? How did they make a living?
Well, that was the economics of Nauvoo is always a challenge. Folks who had some means, who were coming into the church and moving into Nauvoo, would need their homes built, would need furnishings, and there were craftsmen who could assist in all those capacities and begin to make some kind of a wage or a means. One of the unfortunate things is, however, that Nauvoo, to a large extent, had to live on imports, and we imported far more in value, cost-wise, than we realized in exports. So we were not yet, and it probably would be a while, even had the church been permitted to remain there to get us on a good, solid working basis like that. But it was an economy of building houses and furnishing them and developing farmland. And certainly there were exports, but not to the point that would make Nauvoo a real viable economic community.
We think of a city landscape as one that has nice roads and nice sidewalks, curb, gutter, etc. What was the situation in Nauvoo?
Well, we did a little archaeological study of Main Street, various places. That was made possible when a sewer line in one of my winter stays was dug, and we're able to assess Main Street. For the most part, Main Street was an earthen road. Here and there would have been fragments of brick and stone and other things cast out into the streets and to fill up holes and mires there was some gravel that was applied to some areas. But for the most part, that was not the case with Nauvoo streets. Joseph talks about streets being knee-deep in mud and how he stepped out into the mud and picked up the little child and helped carry her along. So in bad weather, Nauvoo streets were no better than really any other community. But yes, there was the attempt to put in sidewalks. So brick laid in a paving format was one of the approaches. And homes had some of those kinds of things leading from the streets up to their homes. But it probably would have been minimal. limestone, which can be harvested in a way that it's flattish, served as like a flagstone to make walkways and some sidewalks. In the archaeological excavations of the Brigham Young property, on the front of his home, we find that sidewalks were at least 6 feet, and I think I'm remembering about 8 feet wide with flat laid limestone laid out and some walkways with gravel, etc. So certainly there was that effort being made. But just to come in, to be able to get into a residence, to be able to get the food supply that a family would need, those were the first priorities. And anything that was left over that could go into creating a nice and convenient landscape around your home was secondary, and that would take time. And of course, there was fencing and some walkways and orchards and gardens, so it was becoming a very pretty place and a productive place. But we're talking about 7 years of Latter-day Saint life in Nauvoo, and that's not many years to get yourself established. So yes, there, as pretty as it was, as pretty and beautiful and fruitful as Thomas L. Cain expressed it, it had some growth to make.
So the image that I have in my mind of a frontier town with boardwalk up and down the streets of its buildings is not accurate.
Well, I shouldn't say that. We wish there was more source material to define that for us. But yes, there would have been efforts to create walkways that would have kept people dry as they walked along, both of the stone and brick and gravel and some boardwalk. But we didn't have just endless blocks of that where people could keep themselves dry and free of those kind of obstacles.
In modern times, or modern urban settings, homeowners are expected to, like, clear the snow. But as I understand it, Nauvoo residents had some additional responsibilities.
Lots of responsibilities. And, of course, there was the wonderful efforts to assist the widow and the fatherless and the aged who were coming in, and the sick and the afflicted. And there were marvelous efforts made on behalf of church members to do those kinds of things. And yes, there were beautiful homes that were built following the martyrdom, say in 1845, a year following the martyrdom. If Joseph would have been permitted to return to Nauvoo and walk its streets, he would have seen quite a different city, because most of the brick buildings were built after the martyrdom. And that would probably have been true of the frame structures as well, that the population increases and the quality of things changing, the amount of gardens and orchards and fencing and painting of things. Enrichment to the city is an ongoing process, and we salute those Latter-day Saints for their accomplishment. But there was struggle. There were many men who were being called off to serve as missionaries in one capacity or another, as proselyting missionaries, but those who were sent up to the Black River area of Wisconsin to cut forests and send building materials to Nauvoo. And lots of things were happening, schools and cultural kind of things into Nauvoo. Yes, they took place, the Nauvoo Brass Band and choirs and different things. And yes, Nauvoo is feeling those wonderful good things, and they would have continued to improve had the Latter-day Saints been able to stay there. But there were lots of other things occupying their time, trying to make a living, trying to get food on the table.
Not to downplay any accomplishments that was made by the creation of the city Nauvoo, but planned versus reality, what were some of the significant differences of how Nauvoo turned out versus how it was platted and originally planned?
Well, certain projects that were hoped would be realized weren't simply because there was not time nor the means to do it. For example, it was anticipated. See, John C. Bennett, the first mayor of Nauvoo, in his inaugural speech, indicated that it was the city fathers were anticipating that a canal would be dug all the way through Main Street, along Main Street, right, you know, through the middle of it, all the way from its north end where it touched on the Mississippi, down to its south end where it also touched on the Mississippi, because the river made a grand sweep around this promontory or grand arc on three sides of the city. So it left both ends of Main Street, north and south, touching the river, if you would. And this canal would have had numerous mills built along it, which would have brought industry into the city and opportunities for economic growth. The unfortunate thing, well, one unfortunate thing was is that a study of the land below, underneath Main Street, indicated that it was underlain by a heavy outcropping of limestone, many feet thick. Well, it would have been impossible to concentrate on creating the canal and the dynamite to help clear that and the work efforts to create such a thing. There were the plans on behalf of the city fathers in Nauvoo to build a dam. This dam would not have extended from Nauvoo across the river to Iowa, but would have extended out into the river and then turned at a right angle and parallel the river. It would have been like a what they call a wing dam, which would have caught the water and brought it into a narrow focus where they could drive many mill wheels. Well, they actually even got started on that dam, but realized that it was just impractical to do that. And their chief aim of our Latter-day Saint people, which was, thank goodness, of course, they had this objective, this fire, this focus, turned to completing the temple. That's where the resources needed to go. And that marvelous structure was completed, allowing the eternal significance of the temple program to unfold in the lives of Latter-day Saints, more than 6,000. So that the temple and other structures such as, well, the beginnings of the Nauvoo House and others took funds, required funds that would have been used for other things.
When it comes to restorative efforts of the streets and sidewalks in Nauvoo, how close are they trying to come, or say with modern traffic, is it even practical to try to do it the same way?
Thank you for that question. There was certainly in the 1960s and 70s, there was the anticipation that Nauvoo would become kind of the Williamsburg of the West, would become in every way a city that would be developed, restored to its historic integrity. The sidewalks would have been created of brick and limestone and things. Whatever archaeological work, for example, or historical sources suggested about a given sidewalk in front of particular structures, we made that effort. But to a certain extent, it really became impractical for maintenance. I think that we still could have done a better job with that. But there were issues of liability. There are those folks who would sue anybody if they could. And so Nauvoo Restoration had to be wise as to the creations of their walkways. They tried to create walkways, sidewalks that would be compatible with historical data, and to an extent they've been able to do that in some cases. But in other cases, we basically had to abandon that because, well, whether we had to or not in all cases, I'm not sure, but it has happened that we have a semblance of restorative work that represents the historical, but in in considerable number of ways, we have had to move away from that.
Are there any other significant findings or stories that you have experienced in Nauvoo?
Archaeologically speaking, I was thinking of the Brigham Young property. This particular site, and let me say, archaeology is not inexpensive. If you consider housing a crew in a city like Nauvoo for a period of 2 months during the summer, as an example, and paying the director and housing him and all these things, it can be very expensive. The Brigham Young home site was excavated in detail, meaning almost every inch, at least around the home site and building sites out in the orchard. We didn't have to do that because we knew where the orchard was. But I mean, even the property lines, finding the where formerly fence posts stood that were now rotted, where, you know, you could actually see those things in the ground as you excavated because of the discolorations in the soil that a round fence post would make, that maybe a cedar post that ultimately in time rotted and left these circles. So the Brigham Young property, you were able to plat the fence lines that encircled the property, where picket fences were, where walkways of limestone and gravel were, where the remains of buildings, one of which Brigham Young's diary speaks of a vaulted structure that served as a, when I say vault, I mean a limestone pit with outlined with a limestone foundation, where the a spring house was located, which was a vaulted structure. Well, in the early archaeological excavations there, this limestone pit, if I'm remembering correctly, 5 or 6 feet long and maybe 3 feet wide was found. And the first archaeologists on the site surmised that to be Brigham Young's spring house. Well, actually, it turned out to be something else. It actually was a privy. And you can just imagine it was a five-holer. And folks going out and using this privy at night with lanterns in their hand, we found three intact chimneys that, very delicate glass chimneys that fell down through the hole and down on something soft, and then in time were covered, and then 100-some years later we excavate the site, and there they are. And all of this broken dishware that had been thrown down the privy. That privy yielded what may very well be as good a find as you would ever find at any household across the American landscape for 1840s dishware. It was just remarkable, the pieces that came out of there that gave us perspectives of the Brigham Young family's lifestyle and even what others in Nauvoo would have experienced as well. That was a very interesting find and very informative. And we learned that it was a privy by doing some soil samples and finding that there were raspberry seeds and strawberry seeds. Well, those raspberry and strawberry seeds, you don't store raspberries and strawberries. You eat them fresh. You pick them and you bring them in. In those days, you eat them because you can't keep them long. Well, how did raspberries and strawberry seeds get in there? Well, it's a body function. And anyway, all this broken dishware that went into this privy was covered and then later found, and it's quite remarkable.
So you've spent most of your professional career doing this type of thing. What can you teach me in a nutshell from what you have learned over these many years?
Well, in archaeological excavations, in assisting to restore homes and structures like barns and cooper shops and smokehouses and building fences and planting fields and planting orchards and all, these people who became Latter-day Saints, who were converts, they were people who wanted to build well and with permanency and have beauty in their lives, and they made genuine efforts to do so. And they were quality people. They were converts to the kingdom because they took the steps to define the gospel for themselves. The promises made in the Book of Mormon, if you would read this book with a sincere heart, these people did that. They were committed to the kingdom. They were willing to go from place to place. Heber C. Kimball mentions, I think, having been moved from, I think it was seven structures, seven homes that he lost. These people were willing to do that. The bulk of Nauvoo, probably 10,000 Latter-day Saints out of that 12, 13, 14 or so thousand people in that area, literally packed up, lock, stock, and barrel, as a city, as a church, with their records, and went off on a difficult and perilous journey to establish themselves in the Rocky Mountains, to be obedient to what they felt was God's divine command, and because they believed in the divine mission of Joseph Smith, the prophet. And they worked and struggled, and they sacrificed. They were willing to build the Nauvoo Temple, if you will, ahead of their own homes and things to a large extent. I think that that these places in Latter-day Saint history represent, symbolize, the commitment of Latter-day Saints to be true to their covenants and loyal to the kingdom and their faith in God and in His prophet.
Thank you, Don. We've been talking about Nauvoo and some of the amazing archaeology that helps us understand a little bit better. And we're talking with Don Enders today of the Church Historical Department. Don, thank you very much for your insight today.
Been nice being with all of you good people.